Silwood, reel number one. Could you explain to me your reasons for joining the Naval Air Service?
Well, I was in Fovent, as a matter of fact, and I was in camp under canvas, and it was a terrifically rainy day and very, very muddy, and I happened to look out the tent, and there was a biplane flying over. And with the love of bird life, which has always interested me, and I thought to myself, well, that's just the job for me. And so I decided to make an application for a commission in the Royal Naval Air Service, previous to which I'd already bought a book about that particular service, and I fell in love with this uniform. Everything seemed to appeal to me very much, and I was always very fond of the sea, and I thought that would be a branch of flying which I should love. So I eventually went to the Lords of Admiralty and was made a probationary flight officer, previous to which, of course, I had about a fortnight's officer's lavatory fatigue. As I was going to become an officer and a gentleman, they usually used to do that sort of thing. And I was eventually made a probationary flight officer and sent to HMS President II.
How did your flying training in the Royal Naval Air Service begin?
Well, from HMS President II, which was the old Crystal Palace, I was transferred to Eastchurch. And there, most of the aeroplanes there seemed to be Morris Farman's, and there I received training in navigation, wireless, and engines, that sort of thing. And most of the time we seemed to spend on the tarmac waiting for some instructor to point the finger at us and say, come on, you can have your first flight.
Do you mean there weren't any things like the formal allocation of instructors to pupils and then rosters set up for flying times? It was not systematic like this?
Well, there certainly didn't seem to be, no, but I think a certain number of we students were given a certain instructor, yes, and he had to get through with us the best that he could, but in some particular cases some of his pupils were possibly, they might have had a crash or they might take an extra long time. And the time factors seemed to be non-existent. Sometimes we'd wait there all day long without a flight, and sometimes 2 or 3 days at a time without a flight.
Do you remember how long it took before you had your first flight?
I should imagine about a week, something approaching a week, I think, before I had my first flight. And then, of course, that was the great day, the first time we'd ever been in the air. That was quite a highlight in our life. And, well, my first flight... But it was rather a bumpy day, and the instructor turned round to me and said, now, don't be nervous, he said, we're tossing about a bit. And I thought to myself, in this thing, sitting bolt upright in the nacelle of a Morris Farman, it was frightfully cold because it was in the winter. And what with the aeroplane bobbing all over the place and the cold, I was beginning to wonder, really, what I'd let myself in for. But nevertheless, he kept me up for about 10 minutes and then went down again. And then the next thing, we were waiting to have dual instruction.
Do you remember what you were issued with in the way of flying kit for this trip?
Well, it's a long time ago, but I think we had an ordinary flying helmet. I think there were sheepskin trousers, 9 sheepskin trousers, which came up to the thigh. I'm not too sure about that. And ordinary gauntlets and goggles, but... if we could afford it, most of we youngsters used to, like, deck ourselves up in possibly leopard skin flying gloves and a different type of helmet, just to be a little different, possibly, to the normal style of dress. And but generally speaking, the main thing is, of course, that as long as we had something to keep us warm, because the Morris Farman flying was such a cold business altogether.
There was no insistence, then, on strict adherence
none
to formal
whatsoever,
military
no,
dress?
No, none whatsoever. The only insistence was that once we had finished flying and got into our Royal Naval Air Service uniform, of course, that we maintained discipline and good manners and good appearance and so on and so forth. Well, then, of course, comes the day when we do our first solo. In my particular case, I got up to 1,000 feet and very, very gingerly turned to starboard, or port, as we used to say in those days, never left or right with the naval jargon. And I got up to about 2,000 or 3,000 feet, and I felt that I kept on swallowing the whole time because the height was affecting me somehow or another. And to cut a long story short, eventually, when I was flying, I used to get some pieces of cheese from the mess, and I used to put them on a little ledge in the nacelle of this aeroplane. And every time my height business worried me, I used to chew a small lump of cheese, and that used to cure it. Used to seem to cure it, in any case.
And presumably it's the same principle as swallowing.
I suppose it is, really. You sometimes get, sometimes when you're in the underground railway and you rush through a tunnel, you get that type of feeling. But later on, I found that when I went up to 10,000 feet, when I was flying another type of aircraft, it was really serious for me. I used to get pain in my head, and I just couldn't cope with it.
Now, after the Morris Farman, what aircraft did you move on to in your training?
I think after the Morris Farman, I got on to Avros with their radio, or shall I say rotary engine, I think they had. And from the Avros on to the Curtiss machine. I had an interesting episode with the Curtiss machine because we had a Canadian instructor, and his particular aeroplane was called Adenac, which is, of course, Canada written backwards. And when my day came for my first solo, he was my instructor. He said, "Now, look, if you treat this aeroplane very carefully, you can do your first solo on my particular aeroplane." So I got out into the middle of the aerodrome, and my prop stopped. Well, of course, the normal thing to do is to call for a mechanic to start your prop. But with the impetuosity of youth and a little bit of show-off, I thought I'd start the prop myself. And, of course, all the boys on the tarmac, they were always interested in solos, first solos particularly. And they saw me do this, and they were yelling words of advice, which I didn't take any notice of. So I swung the prop myself, and although I'd pulled the throttle right back, the aeroplane started moving forwards. So I dashed under the plane, tried to get in the seat. I couldn't get in the seat, and I fell over, and the tailplane hit my head and knocked me to the ground. And there I saw this beautiful aeroplane, which belonged to my instructor, this lovely aeroplane called Adenac, which he treasures so much, actually running away from me. And then it swerved to the left, and I ran after it, and it gradually gained speed until eventually it was beginning to run after me. And I fell over, just as well I did fall over at that point, because the aeroplane took off over my head, flew at about 50 feet up, and eventually crashed. In the meantime, my instructor, of course, was going absolutely mad on the tarmac. His invective, they tell me, was terrible because I'd practically destroyed his lovely machine.
Were there any serious consequences of this
incident? Well, I had to go before my commanding officer later on. He was a high-ranking man in the Royal Naval Air Service, covered in gold bands and things like that. And he told me that pilots, he said, are cheap, he said, but aeroplanes are very, very expensive. And he said, "You made an awful mess of things today." And I really thought I was going to be dismissed the service, and I held my head very low and said I was sorry. But he had a half smile on his face as he told me that, "All right, then, we'll forget it this time." And I passed out all right eventually, so everything was all right.
After about 4 months at Eastchurch, you moved on to Cranwell in April of 1917. What was the difference between the kind of training you had had at Eastchurch and that which you were to receive at Cranwell?
I suppose the training at Cranwell was it was more advanced. We had practice bombing. I think we went to Sleaford for doing bombing runs, and we had cross-country flights to Boston Stump and Lincoln, and also it was our first venture on the Bristol Scout, on which, of course, we received no dual instruction whatsoever. I think my main memory of Cranwell was once when I was flying an Avro, which had a rotary engine, that is to say, the engine and the propeller go round the crankshaft itself instead of vice versa, and I had a broken crankshaft when bits of engine flew all over the place and broke parts of my aeroplane, But fortunately, I got down safely. I think that's the thing which sticks out of my mind mostly about Cranwell, coupled with the fact, of course, we have our first flight on a Bristol Scout. Mm. After Cranwell, I went down to Dover, flying with 1.5 strutters for height tests. This wasn't a customary thing, but in my particular case, as I was a little bit doubtful about this, that's just the reason why I went down there. And I remember on one occasion I went up to 10,000 feet in a sub with 1.5, and I fainted. I fainted in one of those cumulus clouds, and I came to at about 2,000 feet, and when I got down, I had about, I suppose, 8 or 9 inches in play in my flying wires. So after that, one of the instructors, there was an instructor down there who took me up to over 10,000 feet, and I just found the same thing happened again. I couldn't stand height. So as a result of that, they decided me to transfer me to seaplanes, where, of course, in most of my operational work, it wouldn't be necessary to go very, very much higher than 2,000 feet. And that's how I found myself in Calshot. Because when we got to Calshot, the impression that I had was that we seemed to be much more naval at Calshot than anywhere else. Naturally enough, of course, we were flying seaplanes. I was instructed on FBA flying boats. Horrible things to fly they were, very tow-heavy. And, of course, the proverbial old short seaplane as well. Always remember one episode which stands out rather vividly in my mind. I'd only been at Calshot 2 or 3 days. And at dinner one night, I was sitting down having my dinner, and my commanding officer tapped at the table and said, "Probationary Flight Officer Silwood will stand the mess around of drinks for evil thinking." So I said to the man sitting next to me, I said, "Well, I like that." I said, "I never said a bloody word." And again, this commanding officer tapped the table and said, "Probationary Flight Officer Silwood will stand the mess a further round of drinks for swearing at the table." And I think that cost me about £10 altogether. I don't know if that was a naval gimmick or not, but I should always remember that. Nevertheless, I took it in good grace. And I think that the main episode at Calshot was that we got used to the sea in its various moods. We used to take trips down to the Needles and back again. And it was there that I witnessed one of the most extraordinary accidents. One of our chaps flew his aeroplane, or rather his seaplane, into the Hassler wireless mast, which I think, if I remember rightly, was about 300 or 400 feet up. He didn't kill himself. He got chucked out of the aeroplane. He was later rescued by a naval rating who was decorated for the job.
Now, after you'd finished seaplane training, and you moved on to the seaplane station at Portland in October 1917. Can you tell me what your duties at Portland were?
Well, obviously our duties were on anti-submarine patrol and convoy work. And, of course, if a submarine were reported, out we had to go, whether the weather was fair or foul, and it was usually foul. We worked on a rotor system. There was the dawn patrol in season, in its right season. We used to go at about 3 o'clock in the morning, probably stay up 3 or 4 hours. We had certain sections of the channel and the approaches, western approaches, to do, to cover. We used to go over as far as Cherbourg and back again. And if a submarine were seen in the patrol area, it had to be inevitably hostile because no British submarine was allowed in that area. We carried a wireless aerial, which the observer used to unwind as soon as we got sufficient height. We could only send, and then with a bit of luck, we certainly couldn't receive. And we also carried 2 pigeons with us in a box, which if we came down in the ditch, we used to tie a flimsy message to their legs and hope like blazes they got back to our loft at Portland.
My impression in reading about anti-submarine patrols and convoy escort work is that it was rather a tedious, monotonous routine activity. Could you tell me what kind of impressions it made on you?
Well, I think you're right. It was inclined to be tedious and monotonous. In rough weather, of course, we were pretty well occupied with keeping the down seaplane on a level keel. And if we had an engine trouble, which happened frequently, it was a very hazardous business, I can assure you, landing sometimes in the channel. But it was tiring. We'd probably work hour after hour after hour and never even see anything of interest whatsoever. Sometimes we used to occasionally bomb an oil slick. That was fairly common. Very often if a submarine was reported, we'd get out to the spot and we'd find an oil slick, perhaps moving at about 4 or 5 knots, and we'd drop a few bombs ahead of it and see what happens. It was on one of these occasions, incidentally, when my engine conked out and I was down for 16 hours. And
what were the highlights of Portland? What incidences do you remember?
Well, I remember this incident, which I've just mentioned very vividly, because we were lucky to get on the sea to start with, but we made a sort of pancake landing against a big wave and we got down and we released our pigeons. But the trouble is that it was blowing so hard the pigeons wouldn't leave the aeroplane. So we threw everything we had on us at them. I threw my last half crown at them and they eventually got back to the loft, and by a half crown was never better spent, because 16 hours afterwards we were picked up. We were in a pretty sorry state by then, I can assure you. But those were the main hazards of seaplane flying, was the weather mainly, and of course the sea on which we had to land. That was the most hazardous part of the job, I suppose. But looking for a periscope in a rough sea was almost an impossibility. But I remember, too, on another occasion, south of the Isle of Wight, we were told a submarine was on the surface. Well, we thought that was a particularly marvellous opportunity. It was a very, very misty day. There was one of those low sea mists which you used to get very often in the Channel. And my observer shouted to me when we were about 30 miles south of the Needles, he said, "Look, Bill, there's a submarine there. Can you see it through the mist?" And I looked down, I could see a grey hulk on the sea, yes, and we turned round quickly and we dropped 4 100-pound bombs on it. To see a submarine fully awash was something out of this world, marvellous. And we circled a bit and I was wondering what would happen, whether or not I could see any survivors swimming about. But no, it didn't change, except in the fact it changed slightly in its colour. It went from a dull grey to a kind of a dirty cream. So we came down lower in the mist to see what it was. And of course, you know what it was, don't you? You can guess, can't you? It was a whale. That was a bit of an anticlimax.
Now, during this period you were based in Portland, which was a little over a year, how many submarines did you actually spot on your patrols?
Well, believe it or not, in the whole of that period, I only spotted one periscope of a submarine, which we attacked and were lucky enough to get. And this happened when we were on patrol somewhere in mid-channel, and my observer shouted out to me that there's a periscope, and there, sure enough, was a periscope, and it was travelling towards a lone cargo ship coming up channel. So we managed to drop 4 100-pound bombs on it and advised Portland what had happened, and they sent out an armed yacht, and between us the submarine was totally destroyed. Incidentally, after we dropped our bombs, I flew low over this cargo boat, and there was the captain on the bridge, obviously with something in the glass, toasting us as we flew by with a violent waving of arms. And sometime after the war, I participated, my observer and myself, with a certain amount of prize money. I think our prize money came to about £27. Normally, I think in those days, we thought we might have been entitled to the full amount. That was £1,000 between us. But I think we both got about £27. So therefore, the prize money was divided between us and, I presume, the crew of the armed yacht.